He brought out that Witten had been an undercover narcotics officer in an earlier part of his career. As such, he had several confidential sources that fed him tips. None of them, he testified, contacted him through the main number of the police station. That would have been highly unusual and dangerous. They all were given private numbers with which to make contact. That was all well and good, but it did not speak to Gloria Dayton's circumstances, and gave me an easy setup when it was my turn for redirect. I didn't even go to the lectern with my legal pad. Detective Witten, how long ago did you work as an undercover narcotics officer?
I did it for 2 years, 2000 and 2001.
Okay, and do you still have the same cell phone number from those days?
No, I'm in homicide now.
You have a new number?
Yes.
Okay, so what if one of your informants from 2001 wanted to call you today because they had information you needed to have?
Well, I would direct this person to current narcotics investigators.
You're missing the point of the question. How would that old source of yours reach out to you, since the old established method of contact is no longer in existence?
There are a lot of different ways.
Like calling the main number of the police station and asking for you?
I don't see an informant who wants to stay an informant doing that.
Witten understood what I wanted, and obstinately didn't want to give me the point. It didn't matter, though. I was sure the jury understood. Gloria Dayton had no way, after so many years, to contact Agent Marco, but to call the DEA's main number. I gave up and sat down. Witten was dismissed, and I called my next witness, Victor Hensley. Hensley was a Trojan horse witness. He was the 16th name on the original witness list that the defense turned in before the start of trial. In keeping with court protocol, each name on the witness list was followed by a brief description of who the person was and what his or her expected testimony would be. This was to help the opposing side decide how much focus and time to apply to vetting and preparing for the witness's testimony. However, in placing Hensley's name on the list, I didn't want the prosecution to know my true purpose, which was to use him to enter the Beverly Wilshire security videos as defense exhibits. So I listed Hensley's occupation and simply described him as a corroborating witness. My hope was that Forsythe and his investigator Langford would view Hensley as a witness who would confirm that no one had rented the room that Gloria Dayton had gone to on the night of her death. As it turned out, Hensley reported to Cisco during a check-in phone call that during the run-up to the trial, he had only one brief visit at the hotel from Langford and had never spoken to Forsythe at all. All of this boded well for me. I realized as Hensley took the stand, carrying with him a smart-looking leather folder with his notes inside, that I stood a good chance of not only maintaining the momentum begun that morning with Witten, but increasing it. Hensley was in his late 50s and looked like a cop. After he was sworn in, I quickly ran down his pedigree as a former detective with the Beverly Hills Police Department, who retired and took the job in security at the Beverly Wilshire. I then asked him if the hotel security staff had conducted its own investigation of the part the premises had played in the hours before Gloria Dayton's murder.
"Yes, we did," he answered. "Once we became aware that the hotel played a tangential part in this situation, we looked into it."
"And did you take part in that investigation yourself?"
"Yes, I did. I was in charge of it."
I then led Hensley through a series of questions and answers that outlined how he had worked with LAPD detectives and confirmed that Gloria Dayton had entered the hotel that evening and knocked on a guest room door. He also confirmed that the room where she had knocked was empty and that no guest was staying in it. My Trojan horse was now inside the gate, and I got down to work. Now, from the very start, the defendant has claimed to police that a prospective client had called from the Beverly Wilshire and said that he was in that room. Is that possible?
No, it's not possible that a guest was staying in that room. But could someone have gotten in that room somehow and made the call?
Anything's possible. It would have to be someone who had a key.
Is it an electronic key?
Yes.
Did you check to see if someone stayed in that room the night before?
Yes, we checked. And someone did stay in that room the night before. That would have been Saturday night. We'd had a wedding reception in the hotel, and the bride and groom stayed in that suite that night.
When is checkout time?
Noon. But they asked for late checkout because they had an evening flight to Hawaii. Since they were newlyweds, we gladly accommodated them. They left at 4:25 that afternoon, according to our records, meaning they probably left the room at 4:15 or so. We covered this in our investigation.
So the room was occupied until 4:15 or so, and then not rebooked for Sunday night.
That's correct. Because of the late checkout, it was not put on the availability list because housekeeping wouldn't have it ready until much later.
And if someone somehow got access to that room, got in somehow, then he would have been able to use the phone to call out. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Would a call from outside the hotel be put through to that room if the caller requested it?
The policy at our hotel is that no call is transferred to a room without the caller asking for the guest by name. You cannot just call up and ask for room 1210, for example. You have to know the name, and it has to be a registered guest. So the answer is no, the call would not have been put through.
I nodded thoughtfully before continuing. What were the names of the newlyweds who had the suite the night before?
Daniel and...
He opened his yellow folder and checked his notes from the investigation.
Laura Price.
But they were checked out and on their way to Hawaii when all of these events were supposedly happening. Earlier in this trial, the prosecution introduced a video of the police interrogation of the defendant, Andre Lacoste. Are you familiar with it?
No, I have not seen it.
I got permission from the judge to re-show a portion of the interrogation on the overhead screen. In the segment, Andre Lacoste told Detective Witten that he received a blocked call from someone named Daniel Price at about 4:30 the afternoon before the murder. As a security measure, he then asked for a callback number, and the caller provided the phone number and a room number at the Beverly Wilshire. Lacoste said he called the hotel back, asked for Daniel Price's room, and was put through. They made arrangements for escort service at 8 p.m., with Giselle Dallinger being the provider. I turned the video off and looked at Hensley. Mr. Hensley, does your hotel keep records of incoming calls to guest rooms?
No, only outgoing calls, because those are charged to the guest account.
I nodded. How would you explain that Mr. Lacoste had the right name and room number when he called the hotel?
Hensley shook his head. I can't explain it.
Is it possible that because of the late checkout given the newlyweds, the name Daniel Price was still on the guest list that the hotel operator uses?
It's possible, but once they checked out, the name would have been removed from the current guest list.
Is that a human process or a computerized process?
Human. The name is deleted from the current guest list at the front desk when someone checks out.
So if the person handling the assignment at the front desk got busy with other work or other guests, that process might have been delayed, correct?
It could have happened.
It could have happened, I repeated. Isn't 3 o'clock check-in time at the hotel?
Yes, it is.
Is the front desk generally busy at that time?
It all depends on the day of the week, and Sunday check-ins are usually slow. But you're right, it could have been busy at the desk.
I didn't know what any of this got me, but I felt that the jury might be getting bored. It was time to open the trap door in the Trojan horse's belly. Time to come out of hiding and attack. Mr. Hensley, let's move on a bit. You said in your earlier testimony that the hotel's own investigation confirmed that the victim, Gloria Dayton, had entered the hotel on the evening of last November 11th. How did you confirm that?
We looked at video from the cameras and pretty soon we found her.
And you were able to track her by different cameras and video as she moved through the hotel, correct? That's right.
Did you bring a copy of the video from the cameras with you to court today?
Yes, I did.
He pulled a disc out of one of the pockets of his leather folder and held it up for a moment. Did you ever give a copy of that video record to the LAPD investigators who were working on the case?
The detectives came by early in the investigation and reviewed our raw feeds. This was before we put together a single video that tracked the woman they were interested in through the hotel. We later put that together and made all the material available, but nobody came to pick it up until a couple of months ago.
Was that Detective Witten or his partner?
No, it was Mr. Langford from the DA's office. They were prepping for the trial and he came around to collect what we had.
I wanted to turn and look at Forsythe to try to get a read on whether he ever saw the video, because it sure never showed up on any discovery list I had seen. But I didn't look at the prosecutor, because I didn't want to give anything away. Not yet, at least.
Do you see Mr. Langford here in court today?
I asked Hensley.
Yes, I do.
I then asked the judge to tell Langford to stand, and Hensley identified him. Langford looked at me with eyes that were as cold and gray as a January dawn. After he was reseated, I turned to the judge and asked if the attorneys could approach. The judge waved us up, and she knew exactly what I wanted to talk about.
"Don't tell me, Mr. Haller, you didn't get copied on the videos."
"That's right, Judge. The witness says the prosecution has had this material for 2 months, and not a single frame of video was turned over in discovery to the defense.
That's a direct violation of your honor," Forsythe broke in. "I have not even seen these videos myself, so..."
"But your investigator took delivery of them,"
the judge said, in a tone of incredulity that told me she was going to come down on my side on this.
"Your honor," Forsythe sputtered, "I can't explain this. If you wish to question my investigator in camera, I'm sure there is an explanation. The bottom line is all parties are in agreement that the victim visited that hotel in the hours before her death. It's not in dispute. So the trespass here is minimal. No harm, no foul, Judge. I make a motion we press on with the case."
I shook my head wearily. "Judge, there is no way of knowing whether there is no harm and no foul without looking at the videos." The judge nodded in agreement.
"How much time do you need, Mr. Haller?"
"I don't know. There can't be a lot of material. An hour?"
"Very well, 1 hour. You can use the conference room down the hall. My clerk has the key. Step back, gentlemen."
As I walked back to the defense table, I raised my eyes to the railing and found Langford staring back at me. Chapter 38. I borrowed Lorna's iPad back from her after the judge broke for the hour. Since I had already studied the Beverly Wilshire videos at length, my purpose in complaining about the prosecution's discovery violation was actually an effort to conceal my own violation in not providing the same videos to Forsythe. Either way, I didn't need an hour to study them again. Instead, I used the time to watch the surveillance video from the Stratton Sturgis house once more and to strategize its best use in bringing down Marco and Langford on the way to a not guilty verdict for Andre Lacasse. The video was indeed the depth charge I had hoped for. It was waiting below the surface for the prosecution to sail over. When I detonated the charge, Forsythe's ship would sink. My case plan was to take things right up to the bell on Friday and rest my case just before the jury was discharged for the weekend. That would give them 2 full days to consider things before we moved on to closing arguments. This meant I was most likely looking at Friday morning as the introduction point of the Sturgis video. I had plenty of witnesses to present between now and then. At 3:25, there was a single knock on the door, and Lego's courtroom deputy looked in. It said Hernandez on his name tag.
"You're up," he said.
When I got back to the defense table, the video remote and laser pointer were waiting for me at my place. And my defendant was, too. I realized that Andre's downward spiral can now be measured by the hours instead of days. He had actually deteriorated in the hour I had spent in the conference room and he had spent in the courthouse lockup. I squeezed his arm. It felt as thin as a broomstick under his sleeve. "We're doing well, Andre. Hang in there. Have you decided if I get to testify?" This was an ongoing conversation we'd been having during the trial. He wanted to testify and tell the world he was innocent. He believed, not without some merit, that guilty men remain mute and the innocent speak out. They testify. The problem was that, while Andre wasn't a murderer, he was a man engaged in a criminal enterprise. Additionally, his deteriorated physical condition would likely not garner sympathy from the jury. I didn't want him to testify, and didn't think he needed to. I had come to believe, contrary to my earlier instincts, that our best shot at a not guilty verdict was to keep him in his seat. "Not yet," I said. "I'm hoping that it will be so obvious that you're innocent that it won't matter." He nodded, disappointed in my answer. I realized that he had lost so much weight in the 2 weeks since jury selection started that I needed to think about getting him a better-fitting suit. There were only 4 or 5 court days left before the jurors began deliberations, but I thought it was the right thing to do. I wrote a note about it on my legal pad, tore the page out, and then handed it back over the rail to Lorna just as the judge came out from chambers and took the bench. Victor Hensley was recalled to the witness stand, and Judge Lego gave me permission to position myself in the well while I showed the composite Beverly Wilshire security video and asked Hensley questions. I first established through Hensley the date and time of the video that we would watch and had him explain how video from several different cameras was edited together so Gloria Dayton could be tracked in her movements through the hotel. I also had Hensley explain that there were no cameras on the guest room floors because it was a privacy issue. The hotel management apparently thought it was bad for business to film who entered what rooms and when. I handed Hensley the laser pointer so he could keep the red dot on Gloria as she made her way and he narrated. I realized that the video gave the jurors their first glimpse of Gloria in motion. During the prosecution phase, they had seen autopsy photos, mugshots, and screenshots from her Giselle Dallinger websites. But the video was Gloria as a living person. And when I glanced at the jury, I saw that they were fully engaged in watching her. That was what I wanted, because my next set of questions to Hensley would take them in a new direction. I retrieved the remote and the laser and stood back in the well. I started playing the video trail from the beginning and then froze the image when Gloria was passing through the lobby and in front of the man in the hat. "Now, Mr. Hensley, can you look at the screen and tell the jury if you have any members of your staff there in the lobby?" Hensley said the man standing at the elevator alcove was part of the security staff. "Anyone else that you can see?" "No, I don't believe so." "What about this man here?" I put the laser dot on the man in the hat, who is sitting on the divan and looking at his phone. "Well," Hensley said, "we can't see his face in this frame. If you play it until we see his face." I hit the play button and the video advanced. I had drawn eyes toward the man in the hat, but he never changed the position of his head and his face was not seen. The video jumped when Gloria went into the alcove and then stepped onto an elevator. There was a black screen for a few seconds, and then the video showed Gloria getting back on the elevator on the 8th floor and going down to the lobby. When the video jumped again to her exit walk through the lobby, I hit the slow button on the remote and put the laser dot on the man in the hat once again to orient the jurors. I said nothing while all eyes were on the screen. I held the red dot on the man in the hat as he got up and left behind Gloria. I then froze the image a moment before he left the screen. "Does that man work for the hotel?" I asked.
"I could never see the face, but no, I don't think so," Hensley said.
"If you could not see his face, how do you know he isn't an employee?"
"Because he would have to be a floater, and we don't have floaters."
"Can you explain to the jury what you mean by that?"
"Our security is post-oriented. We have people at posts, like the man at the elevator alcove. We are posted and we are visible. Name tags, green blazers. We don't have undercovers. We don't have floaters, guys who float around and do whatever they want."
I started to pace in front of the jury box, first walking toward the witness stand and then turning back to cross the well. With my back turned to Hensley and my eyes on Langford sitting against the rail, I asked my next question. "What about private security, Mr. Hensley? Could that man have been working security for someone staying in the hotel?"
"He could have, but usually private security people check in with us to let us know they're there."
"I see. Then, what do you think that man was doing there?" Forsyth objected, saying I was calling for speculation from the witness.
"Your Honor," I responded, "Mr. Hensley spent 20 years as a police officer and detective before spending the past 10 in security for this hotel. He's been in that lobby countless times and dealt with countless situations there. I think he is more than qualified to render an observation on what he sees on the video."
"Overruled," Lego said.
I nodded to Hensley to answer the question.
"I would bet that he was following her," he said.
I paused, wanting to underline the answer with silence.
"What makes you say that, Mr. Hensley?"
"Well, it looks like he was waiting for her before she even got there. And then, when she comes back down, he follows her out. You can tell when she makes the sudden turn to go to the front desk. That catches him off guard, and he has to correct. Then he follows when she leaves."
"Let's watch it again." I ran the whole video again in real time, keeping the laser dot on the hat. "What other observations do you have about the video, Mr. Hensley?" I asked afterward.
"Well, for one, he knew about our cameras," Hensley said. "We never see his face because of the hat, and he knew just where to sit and how to wear it so he would never be seen. He's a real mystery man."
I tried hard not to smile. Hensley was the perfect witness, honest and obvious. But calling the man in the hat a mystery man was beyond my expectations. It was perfect.
"Let's summarize, Mr. Hensley. What you've told us here today is that Gloria Dayton came into the hotel on the evening of November 11th and went up to the 8th floor, where she presumably knocked on the door of a room where no one was staying. Is that correct?"
"Yes, correct."
"And that when she went back down the elevator and left the hotel, she was followed by a mystery man who is not an employee of the hotel, correct?"
"Again, correct."
"And just over 2 hours later, she was dead," Forsyth weakly objected, on the grounds I was asking a question that was outside the scope of Hensley's knowledge and expertise. Lego sustained the objection, but it didn't matter.
"Then I have no further questions," I said.
Forsyth stood for his cross-examination, but then surprised me.
"Your Honor, the state has no questions at this time."
He must have decided that the best path out of the mystery man debacle was to pay it no mind, give it no credibility, act like it didn't matter, and then retreat with Langford and engineer some kind of response in rebuttal. The problem for me was that I didn't want to put another witness on the stand, but it was only 4:10 and probably too soon in the judge's estimation to end court for the day. I walked to the railing behind the defense table and leaned over to whisper to Sisko.
"Tell me something," I said.
"Tell you what?" he answered.
"Act like you're telling me about our next witness and shake your head."
"Yeah, well, I mean, we don't have another witness, unless you want me to go to the hotel where we stashed Bud Wendell and bring him over."
He shook his head, playing along perfectly, and then continued. But it's 4:10 now, and by the time I got back, it would be 5.
That's good.
I nodded and returned to the defense table.
Mr. Holler, you can call your next witness, the judge said.
Judge, don't exactly have my next witness ready. I thought Mr. Forsythe would have at least a few questions for Mr. Hensley, and that would take us through until 4:30 or 5. The judge frowned.
I don't like quitting early. I told you that at the start of the trial. I said have your witnesses ready.
I understand, Your Honor. I do have a witness, but he is in a hotel 20 minutes away. If you want, I can have my investigator.
Don't be ridiculous. We wouldn't get started until almost 5. What about Mr. Lankford? He's on your witness list.
I turned and looked back at Lankford, as if I was considering it. Then I looked back at the judge. I'm not prepared today for Mr. Lankford, Your Honor. Could we just break for the day now and make up the lost time by shortening our recesses over the next couple days?
And penalize the jury for your lack of preparedness? No, we're not going to do that.
Sorry, Judge.
Very well. I am adjourning court for the day. We will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I suggest you be prepared to begin then, Mr. Holler.
Yes, Your Honor. We stood as the jury filed out, and Andre needed to grab me by the arm to pull himself up. You okay? I asked.
Fine. You did good today, Mickey. Real good.
I hope so. The deputies came for him then. He would be taken back to the courtside cell, where he would change from his baggy suit into an orange jumpsuit. He would then be put on a bus and shipped back to Men's Central. If there were any delays in the process, he would miss chow time in the jail and go to sleep hungry. Just a few more days, Andre.
I know. I'm hanging in.
I nodded, and they led him away. I watched them take him through the steel door.
Isn't that touching?
I turned. It was Lankford. He had come up to the defense table. I looked over his shoulder at Forsythe. The prosecutor was standing over his table, trying to fit a thick stack of files into his thin attaché case. He was not paying attention to Lankford and me. Behind him, the courtroom had emptied. Lorna had gone down to get the car. One of Moya's men had followed her, while the other had moved out into the hallway to wait for me. Sisko and Jennifer had already left the courtroom. It is touching, Lankford, I said. You know why? Because that's an innocent man there, and you don't see too many of those around here. I raised my hand in a who-am-I-kidding gesture. But of course, you know that better than almost anybody, don't you? I mean the part about him being innocent. Lankford shook his head like he didn't get it. You really think you're going to get him off with this mystery man defense? I smiled as I started putting my own files and notes into my briefcase. We're actually calling it the cat-in-the-hat defense, and believe me, it's a lock. He said nothing in response, and I paused my efforts to look at him. 1 Echo Robert 5676.
What's that? Your mother's phone number?
No, Lankford, it's your license plate number. I saw a split-second change in his eyes. It was recognition, or maybe fear. I kept going, improvising, but following some instinctual path to an unknown destination. It's a city of cameras. You should have lost the plate before you started following her. That next witness the judge wanted to hear today, he's bringing video from outside the hotel, and he's going to identify you as the cat in the hat. The look in Lankford's eyes wasn't fleeting anymore. It was the vicious look of a cornered animal. And then you're going to have to explain to the jury why you were following Gloria Dayton before she was murdered, and before you were on the case. Lankford suddenly moved into me, grabbing my tie to jerk me away from the table. But the tie came off in his hand, and he stumbled backwards off balance.
Hey, is there a problem?
Forsythe had taken notice. Langford recovered, and I looked at Forsythe.
No, no problem.
I calmly took my tie back from Langford. His back was to Forsythe. He stared at me with those black marble eyes. I started clipping my tie back on and leaned in to whisper,
Langford, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I don't think you're a killer. I'm guessing you got into something way over your head and you got pushed, used. You found her for somebody and he did the rest. Maybe you knew what was coming, maybe not. Either way, you're going to let an innocent man go down for it? Fuck you, Holler. Your client is scum. All of them are.
Forsythe walked up to us then. I'm leaving now, gentlemen. I ask again, is there a problem here? Do I have to stay here and babysit you two? Neither of us broke our stares to look at the prosecutor. I answered, we're fine. I'm just explaining to Investigator Langford the reason I wear clip-ons.
Fascinating. Good night.
Good night. Forsythe went out through the gate and down the middle aisle of the empty courtroom. I picked up with Langford where I'd left off before the interruption. You've got less than 24 hours to figure out how you want to play this. Tomorrow, your buddy Marco is going to go down. You can go down with him, or you can get smart and get out of this in one piece. There is a way, you know. Langford slowly shook his head.
You don't know what the fuck you're talking about, Holler. You never do. You don't know who you're dealing with. In fact, you don't know shit.
I nodded, as though I felt I had been properly rebuked. Then I guess I'll see you tomorrow. I clapped him on the arm like I was saying goodbye to a good friend.
Don't fucking touch me, he said.
Chapter 39. Under directions from Lorna, Sisko brought wine and pizza from the takeout at Moza to the loft for the post-court staff meeting that night. She said it was warranted because for the first time in 2 weeks of trial and more than 7 months of prep, it felt like there was something to celebrate. It was unexpected to have a mid-trial celebration, but the bigger surprise was seeing Legal Siegel in a wheelchair at the end of the table. He had a mobile air tank on the chair and was happily munching on a piece of pizza. Who sprung you? I asked.
Your girl here,
Legal said, pointing with his pizza at Jennifer.
She rescued me from those people, just in time, too.
He toasted me with his slice, holding it up with two bony white hands. I nodded and looked at everyone. I guess the reluctance to celebrate anything showed on my face.
Come on, we finally had a good day, Lorna said, handing me a glass of red.
Revel in it.
I'll revel in it when it's over and we put the big NG on the scoreboard, I said. I pointed to the whiteboard, which had our defense strategy outlined on it. But I took the glass and a slice of sausage pizza and smiled at the others as I made my way to a chair by Legal Siegel. Once everyone was seated, Lorna initiated a toast to me, and with great embarrassment I held up my glass. I then hijacked the moment and added my own toast. To the gods of guilt, I said, may they release André Lacoste soon. That turned the happy moment somber, but it couldn't be helped. Getting a not guilty verdict was a long shot. Even when you knew in your gut that you were sitting next to an innocent man at the defense table, you also knew that the NGs came grudgingly from a system designed only to deal with the guilty. I had to satisfy myself with knowing, no matter the outcome, that I had done all I could do for André Lacoste. I then cleared my throat, held up my glass, and offered another toast. And to Gloria Dayton and Earl Briggs, may justice be done by our work. The others chimed in, and an impromptu moment of silence followed. It seemed that we were all reminded that the victims in this case were many. I broke the spell by steering everyone back to the business at hand.
before we all get too drunk, let's talk about tomorrow for a few minutes. I went down the line, pointing to each as I gave orders and asked questions. Lorna, I want to go in a little bit early, so pick me up at 7:45, okay? Hey, I'll be there if you'll be there. A not-so-veiled reference to my showing up late that morning. Jennifer, are you with me tomorrow or do you have things on your calendar? I'm there in the morning. In the afternoon, I've got a loan modification hearing. Another foreclosure case, which were still the only cases bringing in any money. All right, Cisco, where are we with the witnesses?
Well, you have Budwin stashed at Checkers. Just let me know whether to bring him to the courthouse. You got my guy from the Ferrari dealership standing by and ready to authenticate. Then you've got the big question. Marco, will he show up or not? I nodded. He has till 10, so I'd better be able to put someone in the chair at 9 when the judge comes out. So bring Budwin over first thing.
You got it.
When does Moya come in?
They won't divulge an exact time for security reasons, but they are transporting him from Victorville tomorrow. I don't think you can count on him in court till Thursday.
That'll work. I nodded. Things seemed to be in place. I would have rather held back Bud Wendell, the gun dealer, until after I knew whether Marco was going to testify, but I had no choice. A trial was always a work in progress, and it almost never rolled out the way you initially planned or envisioned it.
What about going with Lankford ahead of Marco? Jennifer asked, eyeing the witness order I had written along one side of the whiteboard. Would that work?
I have to think about it, I said. It might.
There are no maybes and might-bes in trial,
Legal Siegel announced.
You gotta be sure.
I put my arm on his shoulder and nodded my thanks for his counsel.
He's right. Legal's always right.
Everyone laughed, including Legal. The work questions finished for the moment. We went back to eating. I took a second piece of pizza, and soon the wine worked its way into everybody in the room, and the banter and laughs continued. All seemed well in the Holler & Associates universe. No one seemed to notice that I was not actually drinking my wine. Then my phone started vibrating. I pulled it from my pocket, checking the caller ID before answering, because I didn't want to intrude on the moment. L.A. County Jail. Normally, I wouldn't take a call after hours from the jail. Most of the time it's a collect call from somebody who got my name and number from somebody else. 9 out of 10 times it's somebody who says he has money for private counsel, but ultimately proves to be lying about that and everything else. But this time, I knew there was a good chance it was Andre Lacoste. He had taken to calling me from the jail after court to discuss what had happened that day and what to expect the next. I stood up and worked my way around the table so I could walk out into the loft and be able to hear the call.
Hello? I'm looking for Michael Holler.
It wasn't Andre, and it wasn't a collect call. I instinctively closed the door to the boardroom to further insulate myself from the noise.
This is Holler. Who's this?
This is Sergeant Rowley at the Men's Central Jail. I'm calling to tell you that there's been an incident involving your client Andre Lacoste.
He had pronounced Lacoste wrong.
What do you mean? What incident?
I started pacing across the empty wooden floor, putting more space between me and the boardroom.
The inmate was assaulted early this evening in the transportation center at the criminal courts building. Another inmate is being investigated.
Assaulted? What does that mean? How bad is it?
He was stabbed multiple times, sir.
I closed my eyes. Is he dead? Is Andre dead?
No, sir. He was transported in critical condition to the jail ward at County USC Medical Center. No other details on his condition are available at this time.
I opened my eyes, turned, and unconsciously raised my left hand in an impotent gesture. A sharp pain shot through my elbow, reminding me of my injury, and I dropped my arm to my side.
How could this happen?
What exactly is the transportation center at CCB?
The TC is the staging area in the courthouse basement where custodies are loaded on buses for transport back to our different holding facilities. Your client was about to be transported back to Men's Central when the assault took place.
Aren't these people in shackles? How could...
Sir, the incident is under investigation, and I can't...
Who is the investigator? I want his number.
I'm not at liberty to give you that information. I'm only calling as a courtesy, to tell you that there has been an incident and your client is at County USC. Yours is the only name on his sheet here.
Is he going to make it?
I don't know that information, sir.
You don't know shit, do you?
I disconnected before I heard a reply.
I started walking toward the boardroom.
Lorna, Sisko, and Jennifer were standing behind the glass window watching me. They knew something was up.
Okay, I said after entering. Andre got stabbed in the courthouse before they put him on the bus tonight. He's at County USC.
Oh my God,
Jennifer exclaimed. Her hands went to her face. She had sat next to Andre through several days of the trial, often whispering in his ear explanations about what I was doing when I dealt with witnesses. I was too busy with the trial. She had become the chief handholder, and that had drawn them close.
How? Sisko said.
Who?
I don't know.
They said another inmate is under investigation.
This is what I want to do. I'm going to go to County USC and see what his status is, and if I can get in to see him.
Sisko, I want you on the investigation. They wouldn't tell me the name of the suspect. I want to know who it is, and what connections he could have to Marco and Lankford.
You think they're behind this?
Lorna asked. Anything's possible. I spoke to Lankford today after court. I tried to rattle him, but he didn't rattle. Maybe he knew what was going to come down.
I thought you had Moya's people protecting him, Jennifer said.
In the jail module, yeah, I said. But it would be impossible to cover the buses and the courthouse. It's not like I could get him a bodyguard.
What do you want me to do? She asked.
I want you to take legal back first. Then I want you to blueprint an argument against mistrial. Jennifer seemed to come out of the shock of the moment and focus for the first time on what I had just said.
You mean?
I was told he was in critical condition. I don't know if that means he's going to live or die. But either way, I doubt he's going to court in the foreseeable future. The default setting on that is to go to mistrial and start over when he's recovered. If Lego doesn't come to that on her own, then Forsythe will make the motion because he saw his case start to go sideways today. We have to stop it. We're about to win this case. Let's proceed with the trial. Jennifer pulled a pad and pen up from her bag that was on the floor.
So we want to continue the trial with Andre in absentia? I'm not sure that will fly.
They proceed with cases when defendants escape during trial. Why not here? There's got to be a precedent. If not, we need to make one. Jennifer shook her head.
In those escape cases, the defendants forfeit the right to be present by their own actions in escaping. This is different.
Not interested in the legal discussion, Sisko stepped out into the loft space so he could start working his phone.
No, it's different but the same, I said. It's just going to come down to the judge and judicial discretion.
Judicial discretion is a big fucking tent, Legal said.
I nodded and pointed at him. He's right, and we have to find space in that tent.
Well, I would say that at the very least, we are going to need a waiver from Andre, Jennifer said. The judge won't even consider it if Andre hasn't signed off, and we don't know if he's in a condition to sign or understand any of this.
Pull out your computer and let's write up the waiver right now. There was a printer on the counter beneath our whiteboard. We had set things up for printing in the loft after my car was wrecked, and the printer I had was destroyed.
You're sure he'll be able to knowingly sign? Jennifer asked.
Don't worry, I said. You write it up. I'll get it signed. I spent 6 hours in a family waiting room on the lockdown floor at County USC. For the first 4 hours, I was repeatedly told that my client was in surgery.
I was then told he was in recovery, but that I could not see him because he had not regained consciousness. During the whole time, I never lost my cool with anyone. I did not complain, and I did not yell. But by 2 o'clock in the morning, I had reached the limits of my patience and started demanding to see my client at 10-minute intervals. I pulled out the full arsenal, threatening legal action, media attention, even FBI intervention. It got me nowhere. By then, I had received 2 updates from Cisco on his investigation of the investigation. In his first call, he confirmed much of what we had suspected, that a fellow inmate who had been in the courthouse for his own trial had attacked Andre, using a shiv fashioned from a piece of metal. Though shackled at the waist like all the men waiting in lines to load onto jail buses, the suspect dropped to the ground and managed to slip the waist chain down over his feet, freeing his movements enough to attack Andre and stab him 7 times in the chest and abdomen before he was overpowered by jail deputies. In his second call, Cisco added the name of the suspect, Patrick Sewell, and said he had found no connection so far by case or other means to either DEA agent James Marco or DA investigator Lee Langford. The name of the assailant was familiar to me, and then I remembered that Sewell was the defendant in the death penalty case my half-brother was in trial with. I recalled that Harry had said Sewell was brought down from San Quentin, where he was already serving a life sentence. This told me Sewell was the perfect hitman. He had nothing to lose. I told Cisco to keep working it. If he came up with even a slim connection between Sewell and Marco or Langford, then I'd be able to create enough smoke to make Judge Lego think twice about calling a mistrial. "I'm on it," Cisco said. I expected nothing less. At 3:10 in the morning, I was finally allowed to see my client. I was escorted by a nurse and a detention deputy into the high-dependency unit of the medical wing. I had to gown up because of the risk of infection to Andre, and then I was able to enter a surgery recovery room where Andre's frail body lay attached to a concert of machines, tubes, and hanging plastic bags. I stood at the end of the bed and just watched as the nurse checked the machines and then lifted the blanket over him to look at the bandages that wrapped Andre's entire torso. His upper body was propped at a low angle on the bed, and I noticed that next to his right hand was a remote for setting the bed's incline. His left wrist was handcuffed to a thick metal eyelet attached to the bed's side frame. Though the prisoner was barely clinging to life, no chances were being taken with the possibility of escape. Andre's eyes were puffy and half open, but he wasn't seeing anything. "So, is he going to make it?" I asked. "I'm not supposed to tell you anything," the nurse said. "But you could. The first 24 hours will tell the tale." At least it was something. "Thank you." She patted my arm and left the room, leaving the deputy standing in the doorway. I walked over to the door and started to close it. "You can't close that," the deputy said. "Sure I can. This is an attorney-client conference." "He's not even conscious." "Right now he isn't, but it doesn't matter. He's my client, and we are entitled by the U.S. Constitution to private consultation. You want to stand in front of a judge tomorrow and explain why you failed to provide this man, who is now the victim of a vicious crime, his inalienable right to confer with his attorney?" In the sheriff's department, all academy graduates are transferred directly into the detention division for their first 2 years on the job. The deputy in front of me looked like he was 24 at the most, and maybe even still on probation. I knew he would back down, and he did. "All right," he said. "You have 10 minutes. After that, you're out of here. Doctor's orders." "Fine." "I'll be standing right out here." "Good. I feel safer already." I closed the door. Chapter 40. Judge Lego brought the attorneys into chambers first thing the next morning. Langford was invited in with Forsythe,
so he could brief the judge on what was known in regard to the stabbing of André Lacasse. Langford, of course, couched it in terms of the kind of random violence that happens often between incarcerated men.
"Most likely, it will be determined to be a hate crime," he said. "Mr. Lacasse is a homosexual. The suspect is already convicted of one murder and is on trial for another."
The judge nodded thoughtfully. I could not counter Langford's insinuations, because so far Sisko had not come up with any link between Patrick Sewell, Lacasse's suspected assailant, and Marco and Langford. My response was weak at best. "There's still a long way to go in the investigation," I said. "I would not jump to any conclusions yet."
"I'm sure they won't," Langford said.
He didn't have the judgmental smirk that was customary on his face. I read that as an early indication of something changing in Langford. Maybe it was the weight of knowing he wasn't in the clear. If the attack on Lacasse was, as I believed, an attempt to end the case by eliminating the defendant, then it had failed. The question now was how badly it had failed.
"Your Honor," Forsyth said, "in light of these events and the recovery time the victim will certainly need, the state moves for a mistrial. I really don't see any alternative. We will not be able to guarantee the integrity of the trial or the jury if the case is continued until the defendant reaches a condition in which he can come back to court, if he ever reaches that condition."
The judge nodded and looked at me.
"Does that make sense to you, Mr. Haller?"
"No, Your Honor, not at all. But I would like my colleague Ms. Aronson to respond to Mr. Forsyth. She is better prepared than me. I spent the night at the hospital with my client." The judge nodded to Jennifer, and she responded with a beautiful and unrehearsed argument against mistrial. With every sentence, I grew prouder of the fact that I had picked her for my team. Without a doubt, she would someday leave me in the dust. But for now, she was working for me and with me, and I could not have done better. Her argument had three concise points, the first being that to declare a mistrial would be prejudicial to the defendant. She cited the cost of mounting the defense and the continuation of André Lacasse's incarceration, the physical toll it would take, and the simple fact that with the prosecution team having seen most of the defense's case, it would be allowed with a mistrial to retool and be better prepared for the next trial.
"Your Honor, that is not fair in any perception," she said. "It is prejudicial."
In my opinion, the argument was good enough on its own to win the day, but Jennifer hammered it down with her next two points. She cited the cost to taxpayers that a new trial would certainly entail, and she concluded that the administration of justice was best served in this case by allowing the trial to continue. These last two points were particularly genius, because they hit the judge where she lived. A judgeship was an elected office, and no jurist wants to be called out by an opponent or a newspaper for wasting taxpayer dollars. And the administration of justice was a reference to the discretion the judge had in making this decision. Lego's ultimate goal was the administration of justice in this matter, and she had to consider whether cutting and running on the case allowed for it or precluded it.
"Ms. Aronson," the judge said after Jennifer submitted, "your argument is cogent and persuasive, but your client is in a hospital bed in a critical care unit. Surely you're not suggesting that we bring the jury to him? I think the court is faced with a dilemma here with only one solution."
This was the only part that was rehearsed. The best way to get what we wanted was to lead the judge to it, not come out of the gate with it.
"No, Judge," Jennifer said. "We think you should proceed with the case without the defendant present after admonishing the jury not to consider the defendant's absence."
"That's impossible," Forsyth blurted out. "We get a conviction, and it will be reversed on appeal in 5 minutes flat. The defendant has the right to face his accusers."
"It won't be reversed if the defendant has knowingly waived his right to appear," Jennifer said.
Yeah, that's great, Forsythe responded sarcastically. But last I heard, your client is lying unconscious in a bed, and we have a jury sitting out there in the box ready to go.
I reached into my inside jacket pocket and pulled the waiver I'd taken to County USC the night before. I handed it across the desk to the judge. That is a signed waiver of appearance, Judge, I said.
Wait a minute, Forsythe said,
the first notes of desperation creeping into his voice.
How can that be? The man's in a coma. I doubt he could sign anything, let alone knowingly sign it.
The judge handed the waiver to Forsythe. Langford leaned over from his chair to look at the signature. I was at the hospital all night, Judge. He was in and out of consciousness, which is not the same as being in a coma. Mr. Forsythe is throwing around medical terms he doesn't know the meaning of. That aside, during my client's periods of consciousness, he expressed to me the strong desire to continue the trial in his absence. He doesn't want to wait. He doesn't want to have to go through this again. Forsythe shook his head.
Look, Judge, I don't want to accuse anyone of anything, but this is impossible. There's just no way that this—
Your Honor, I said evenly, as though it didn't bother me that Forsythe was calling me a liar. If it will help with your decision, I have this. I pulled my cell phone and opened up the photo app. I went to the camera roll and expanded the shot I had taken in my client's hospital room. It showed Andre in his bed, propped at a 45-degree angle, a bed table positioned across his midsection. His right hand was on the table, holding a pen and signing the waiver. The shot was angled down from Andre's right side. The angle and the swelling around his eyes made it impossible to tell if his eyes were open or closed. I handed the phone to the judge. I had a feeling Mr. Forsythe would object, so I took this quick shot, something I learned from my process server. There was also a deputy on the room named Evanston. If necessary, we can wake him up and bring him to court to attest to the signature. The judge pointedly handed the phone back to me instead of letting Forsythe look.
The photo isn't necessary, Mr. Holler. You're an officer of the court, and I take you at your word.
Your Honor? Forsythe said.
Yes, Mr. Forsythe?
I would like to request a brief delay to allow time for the state to consider and formulate a response to the defense.
Mr. Forsythe, this is your motion, and on top of that, you were the one just moments ago reminding the court that there was a jury waiting to proceed.
Then, Your Honor, the state requests that the court conduct a thorough examination of the defendant and assure that the waiver Mr. Holler purportedly has was indeed voluntarily and knowingly signed by the defendant. I had to head this off before one of Forsythe's desperate attempts to stop the trial took hold.
Your Honor, Mr. Forsythe is a desperate man. He obviously will say anything to stop this trial. You have to ask yourself why, and I think the answer is that he knows he is going down. We are proving that Mr. Lacoste is innocent in there, and the jury, the gallery, everyone knows it, including Mr. Forsythe. And so he wants to stop it. He wants a court-sanctioned do-over. Judge, are you really going to allow this? My client is an innocent man, and he has been jailed and abused and deprived of everything, including possibly his very life. The administration of justice demands that this trial continue. Right now. Today. Forsythe was about to bark back, but the judge held up her hand to stop him.